Welcome to the Student Press Law Center Podcast, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit source of information and advocacy for the student media, and we work to break down the barriers that prevent college and high school journalists from doing their best work. For more information about the center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lamani, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. Young people's ability to publish online anytime and anywhere has provoked a flurry of responses from legislators and from the courts. Many of these pronouncements have blurred the boundaries that used to confine schools' disciplinary authority within the proverbial schoolhouse gate. Those blurry boundaries are in somewhat clearer focus today as a result of a pair of rulings from the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. In two companion cases decided on June 13th, the court sent an unmistakable message that schools do not have unlimited authority over what students say and write when they are off campus. The Philadelphia-based court decided that school officials overreached when they suspended two Pennsylvania students, one in high school and one in middle school, for creating mock MySpace profiles ridiculing their principals. These cases, Layshock versus Hermitage School District and JS versus Blue Mountain School District, represent the first time that the issue of school authority over off-campus online speech has come before an in-bank appeals court comprised of all of a circuit's active judges. Well, with us to discuss the impact of these First Amendment rulings is the attorney who argued both the Layshock and the JS case on behalf of the students, Vic Walczak, who is legal director of the ACLU of Pennsylvania. Mr. Walczak is a veteran constitutional lawyer who has tried precedent-setting cases on behalf of prisoners' rights and the rights of undocumented immigrants as well as public school students. And he is a graduate of Colgate University and Boston College Law School. It is a real honor and pleasure to have with us one of the country's leading experts on the law of student rights. And Vic, maybe you can start us off just by fleshing out a little of the factual background about how these two very similar cases got started in the first place.
Well, first of all, Frank, thank you for that very kind introduction. You're really overstating my qualifications there, but thank you very much. Layshock started in 2006, and JS started in 2007, and probably all most listeners need to know is that it involves MySpace, which probably tells you more about how old the cases are than anything else. And the facts in the two cases are remarkably similar. You had in Layshock a high school student, in JS a middle school student, both of whom had been mildly disciplined for minor infractions by their principal. And they were, you know, ticked off. And as kids do, they needed a way to lash out. These are not kids who are violent. These are not kids who've had disciplinary problems in the past. Both times this was their first incident. And they both chose sort of the same way to get back at their principals, and that was to create these mock profiles on MySpace, which is really them pretending to be the principal and making something up like you might see in Mad Magazine or National Lampoon, and then I'm probably dating myself there. And Justin's was kind of a takeoff on a theme of big, where the principal is a large man, he's not corpulent, and the kids sort of thought it was funny because he wore his clothes too tight, and so Justin took a pre-printed questionnaire, which asks, you know, what's your favorite food, big pizza, what's your favorite drink, big keg, what's your eye color, big, and just about every question he answered with some theme of big. Some of the questions included references to drugs and alcohol, so there was, you know, big keg and big blunt and big steroids and big dick, and I'm not sure I can say that. Is the FCC going to get on me? And so that was Justin's. In the JS case, the student was an eighth grader in a time when kids are getting health and being exposed to sex. So it was much more sexual, and suggested that this guy liked to do it with kids. I mean, it really was quite crude. But in both of these cases, anybody looking at it would easily be able to tell that this is not the principal. This is somebody making fun of the principal. And these were posted online. They were posted in a way that it was only viewable by friends. The principals heard about it. You know, these are small communities, and word gets around. And the principals weren't able to access the profiles themselves. They got other kids to bring them in once they found the profiles, identified who had put them up, and then they threw the book at them. They suspended both of the kids for 10 days, and in Justin's case, he was an honors student. He was kicked out of all of his AP classes.
Well, just to sort of play devil's advocate here for a second, as you described the speech, I think nobody would call this sophisticated social commentary or journalistic speech. So why should we care about speech that has this kind of a low qualitative value to it?
Right. I think there's several reasons it should be of concern to people. The big legal issue in these cases is what authority do school officials have to reach beyond the schoolhouse gate into the community and even into a student's home and dictate what those kids can say? Mm-hmm. And what the Supreme Court has done over the last 40 years since the Tinker case is to say, look, when kids go to school, they lose some of their speech rights. School officials have and must have greater authority to regulate what kids say and how they express themselves, just so they can keep schools orderly, so they can create an environment that's conducive to learning. And as we know, sometimes they regulate a little bit too much and the environment gets oppressive and you wonder whether they really are learning. But the bottom line is school officials have a lot of authority to restrict what kids say when they're in school. And the question is, do you want to give them that authority when the kids are outside of school? And beyond that issue of just authority is that while this may not be the highest form of intellectual discussion, not allowing the speech would not bring down the republic, but the long-standing principle in free speech is that in order to protect the speech that is truly important, you have to protect much more than that. You have to protect speech that may not be all that valuable. And it's especially important in these cases because school officials have used that power that the courts have given them over students inside the school to restrict socially valuable speech. I mean, take a hot-button issue like gay rights. Depending on the community, depending on the politics of the officials, you've had principals restricting students who want to promote gay-straight alliances or who want to speak out about a day of silence and promote gay rights. And then you've had school officials in other communities where the politics are different, and they're going to be punishing anybody who's going to be saying any kind of anti-gay comments. And while when those comments create a substantial material disruption in the school, they can and should be restricted appropriately inside the schools. Giving that kind of power to school officials over kids who are outside of the schools is extremely dangerous because you're essentially allowing school officials to override what the parents, what the community, whatever the religious institution involved in that family would have to say about these very important issues.
Right. Well, to fast forward to get us to the Third Circuit in-bank ruling, both the students in these cases challenged the discipline under the First Amendment. Justin Layshock, the high school student, wins his case at the district court level and then at the circuit court level. JS, the middle school student, does not prevail in her case. The ruling goes in favor of the school. And in fact, the Third Circuit, two different three three-judge panels of the Third Circuit back last year, 2010, come out with these seemingly irreconcilable rulings, one of them saying that the speech was protected under the First Amendment and was exempt from punishment, and one saying that it was not. So that gets us to the Third Circuit decision. So I guess explain to us now the decisions that came out on Monday the 13th. How did the Third Circuit reconcile these two cases?
Right, and the first time that they ruled, when you just had three judges on each of the cases and you had really inconsistent outcomes, can be explained by the fact that you just had different judges, and, mm-hmm. and the different judges took different approaches. And that was the reason that they decided that the whole court should hear them and try to harmonize the decisions, is the language that the court often uses. The reason that the results are different, I think, stems from the fact that the school districts made different arguments in the cases. So in Layshock, the court ruled 14 to nothing, and I like saying that because I don't think I've ever won a case by two touchdowns. I have 14 judges deciding a case. But the argument that the school district, supported by the Pennsylvania School Boards Association, made in Layshock is that the school could punish off-campus speech simply because it was vulgar. And because it was on the internet, it could be accessed at school. And that's a pretty dangerous kind of argument. Talk about far-reaching. So anytime a kid swears out in the community, the school could come in and punish that kid. And fortunately, all 14 of the judges on the court rejected that argument and said, no way, just because the speech is vulgar does not give school officials the authority to punish the students if they are outside of school. Any kids are listening, don't think this gives you any license to swear at your teacher in school, because you're going to get in trouble just as fast as you would have before these decisions. This only applies to off-campus speech. JS, the school raised different arguments, and what they were saying is initially that the speech caused a substantial and material disruption. And that may sound familiar to people. It comes from a case called Pinker versus Des Moines, decided 40 years ago, which really is the standard, the principal standard in school. And what the evidence showed is that there's no way they can legitimately claim that there was a substantial material disruption. Their evidence was that a couple of kids were talking in class and a teacher had to tell them to stop. Well, that's not material disruption. That's what happens in school every day. They shifted gears and argued that based on these facts, because you had students saying crude things about school officials, it was likely and it was foreseeable that it would lead to a substantial material disruption. A majority of the court, eight of the judges, rejected that argument and said, no way. You look at the facts of this case, while it may have been vulgar, while it may have been unpleasant for the officials, there's no way you could forecast that this would create a material disruption. On the other hand, you had six judges on the court who were willing to throw the book at these kids and took the position that anytime you've got students who are saying vulgar things about school officials, that you can presume that it's going to create a substantial material disruption, which really would have wiped out kids' rights outside of school, and it effectively would have allowed school officials to punish kids simply for swearing and using crude language and using vulgar language about school officials.
Sure. Well, one of the things that was left not completely resolved is whether the standard in Tinker that you just mentioned, the substantial disruption standard, is going to be the same standard to apply to off-campus as to on-campus speech, or whether a more First Amendment protective standard is going to apply once students are outside of the school building and not attending school events. Tell us about the two strains of thought that were set forth in the concurring and dissenting opinions there, and I guess which one do you think has the better side of the argument?
Right. The issue is, does the Tinker standard, which is the most protective in school standard, substantial material disruption. Does that apply to off-campus speech? And we frankly argued that that is not sufficiently protective, that when kids are outside of school, that they have essentially the same right as adults. They're subject to discipline by their parents, and that you can't even apply Tinker. What a majority of the court in JS decided is that that's an interesting question. It's an important question that hasn't been resolved. And we don't have to resolve it in this case because the school can't even satisfy Tinker. So we don't need to decide whether the standard is greater than Tinker. And so they ruled on the basis of Tinker. Five of those eight judges were prepared to go further and essentially accept our argument that when kids are outside the school, that they have the same speech rights as adults. And that wouldn't mean that school officials can never punish the kids, but there would have to be extraordinary justification for doing that. So, I mean, if a kid made a false bomb threat, sort of like yelling,
sure,
falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater, that's not protected speech. You know, that's something the kid could be punished for. Potentially, if you have extreme situations of bullying that are having kids hospitalized and preventing them from participating in school, perhaps that could be a justification. But that the Tinker standard does not apply anywhere outside the confines of the school or school-sponsored activities. But unfortunately, that's not the law. And it remains to be seen whether the Supreme Court will view either of these two cases as a suitable vehicle for resolving this issue. At this point, we don't know whether the school districts will try to ask the Supreme Court to hear the case, but we have had some indications that they may do that.
Right. Well, if the Tinker issue, the exact boundaries of schools' disciplinary authority was left unresolved, there were certainly some important subsidiary issues that were resolved, and you alluded to one of them a minute ago, which is this idea that lewd speech or speech of a sexual nature that references school officials somehow is enough in and of itself to drag the speech onto campus for school disciplinary purposes. That was pretty soundly rejected. So I guess maybe talk a little bit about what was resolved and what we do know now that we didn't know a week ago, thanks to the Third Circuit.
Right. Well, and first of all, let me just, I think that needs to be qualified that even though this is the entire Third Circuit, it is binding only on courts in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and the Virgin Islands. You figure out which one doesn't belong there. and so it doesn't apply in outside of those states. It hopefully will be persuasive, not until the Supreme Court decides it, will you have law for the entire United States. But it's
right.
It's still a big deal to have the full Court of Appeals make the decision. So I think the important points are, one, that the court made very, very clear that what's known as the Fraser standard, which in school you can punish kids for sexually lewd or vulgar language, that cannot apply to out-of-school speech. That's important because there have been other courts around the country that have suggested that maybe you can use that standard, and here all 14 judges unequivocally repudiated that argument. Second, the issue is, in JS that came out, is that that the default standard for judging speech is Tinker, which is the substantial material disruption case. And that's important because there have been some other courts around the country that have suggested that it is a lesser standard, that it may be under Fraser, that it may be under another case called Morse, and that school officials, in fact, do not need to show substantial material disruption in order to punish speech. And again, the Third Circuit, or at least eight of the judges, a majority, said, no. If it's not sexually lewd and vulgar, if it's not school-sponsored like in a newspaper, and if it's not a pro-drug message, then the school has to show substantial material disruption in order to justify censorship of that message. And the second point, and this may be a little lawyerly, but it is extremely important, is that substantial material disruption means really, really causing a problem. because what we've seen around the country is that any time school officials are offended or don't like what a kid is saying, they know it's burned into their brains that they can justify censorship if they can say, substantial and material disruption. And when they're put to the proof, all they typically come up with is, you know, a couple of kids talking. There was some commotion in class, but you know, this is not substantial material disruption. This is what happens in schools every day. And what the Third Circuit has said in the JS case is that, look, when we say substantial and material disruption, we really mean it, and just talking in class is not enough. And so hopefully that will be a strong message, and certainly I think will form a strong body of law for students in the future who may be disciplined for saying something that simply offends school officials but doesn't really create a disruption inside the school.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you again, Vic Walczak of the ACLU of Pennsylvania, for being with us today, for giving such an easy-to-follow explanation, and also congratulate you for two very hard-earned victories in the Layshock and the JS cases, and for all the work that you and the ACLU do on behalf of the constitutional rights of students. Those of you who are interested can read copies of the Layshock and the JS court rulings on the Student Press Law Center's website. That's www.splc.org, where you'll also find other guides to help you understand and protect your legal rights. We hope you'll subscribe to the RSS feed for the SPLC's news alerts, that you'll join the Student Press Law Center's group on Facebook, and follow SPLC on Twitter. And if you're a student journalist or an educator with any question about the law, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thank you for listening.